There has been a disconnect with what our expectations are and should be as it relates to interactions with our officers.
That was Keisha Lance Bottoms, mayor in Atlanta, Georgia, on calls for bipartisan legislation addressing police reform in America. It's Tuesday, June 16th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Amy Polpe-Boone in Washington, D.C. Also ahead, a look at how policing has evolved in America. One General Lee statue is under debate on whether it should be taken down. A U.S. astronaut made a historic visit to the deepest parts of the ocean. It's all on today's VOA Asia. A deadly police shooting in Atlanta, Georgia, has further fueled unrest and demonstrations against racism and police brutality. The call for bipartisan legislation addressing police reform nationwide grows as protests across the country and the world continues. VOA's Kane Fehrenbaugh reports.
On Friday night, Atlanta police officers approached 27-year-old Rashard Brooks, who appeared to be asleep behind the wheel of his car while waiting in line at a fast food restaurant drive-thru. When officers tried to detain Brooks, he resisted arrest, leading to a scuffle. In the moments that followed, recorded in a series of police body cameras, restaurant surveillance footage, and bystander cell phone videos, Brooks appears to use one of the officers' tasers as he flees. The incident ends when one of the officers opens fire, leading to Brooks' death.
While there may be debate as to whether this was an appropriate use of deadly force, I firmly believe that there is a clear distinction between what you can do and what you should do. I do not believe that this was a justified use of deadly force and have called for the immediate termination of the officer.
A day later, the officer who pulled the trigger was fired. The Atlanta police chief resigned, and the fast food restaurant where the incident occurred was engulfed in flames as anger over Brooks's death led to unrest on the streets of Atlanta, in a country already on edge in the wake of previous deadly police encounters.
We need reformation of how police officers do their jobs, how law enforcement does its job. Because what happened yesterday to Rashard Brooks was a function of excessive force and the decision that the fact that they were either embarrassed or, panicked led them to murder a man who they knew only had a taser in his hand.
There has been a disconnect with what our expectations are and should be as it relates to interactions with our officers and the communities in which they are entrusted to protect.
It's a disconnect lawmakers in Washington are increasingly under pressure to resolve with bipartisan legislation that addresses police reform, especially in the wake of the recent death of George Floyd in police custody in Minneapolis. Republican Senator James Lankford from Oklahoma says he would support a ban on police use of chokeholds.
There's been a longstanding principle out there that is not needed for that situation. And there's been a consensus document that was done in 2017 by law enforcement around the country to say that is not needed. So I think that's not an issue for us.
Former New Jersey governor and Republican candidate for president in 2016, Chris Christie, points to successes in police reform in the city of Camden, New Jersey, as an example for other communities to follow.
We got police officers out of their cars, onto bicycles, on foot, and embedded them in the community, both from a law enforcement perspective and socially, George, working with the communities and working with young men and women in the communities to develop trust. Second was de-escalation training. And the watchword for the de-escalation training is first do no harm, and that violence is a last resort.
While lawmakers in Washington seek to find common ground on legislation, some states have already passed sweeping police reforms in response to the protests that have dominated headlines across most American cities over the last several weeks. Kane Fehrenbaugh, VOA News.
These are among the top Asia headlines you'll find right now on voanews.com. Australian Prime Minister says he's sad and concerned over countryman's death sentence in China. Refusing to be gagged, Myanmar journalists work from the shadows. Solar rules weaken Vietnam's love-hate relationship to coal. U.S. Climate Agency change reports May global temperatures tied for the warmest ever. In South Korea, U.S. officials demonstrate Black Lives Matter solidarity. You'll find all these stories and expanded coverage when you visit Facebook at VOA Asia and our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Amy Polby Boone in Washington, D.C. With continued protests around the world, here in the U.S., defunding and police reform has taken the spotlight. VOA's Steve Miller speaks with Dr. David Thomas, who is a forensic studies professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. Thomas dives into what he believes what policing should look like.
The role here in America is a very diverse role. When I started, all it was in 1978, the job was people violated the law. It was take and put those violators in jail. It evolved. And I can tell you, because I started in 78 and I retired in 1998. So I've kind of gone through each one of these decades with this understanding. And somewhere in the 80s, when they let everybody out of the mental institutions and they just turned them loose on the streets, we all of a sudden became health workers with no training. Today, there's some training, but there's no training. And we are responsible for making an assessment of somebody if they're a threat to themselves or somebody else, and then transporting them. The 90s was going on. We still were doing the same thing, but we got better educated. You know, policing now, you know, CIT, which is officers are trained to be able to respond and deal with critical people who are in mental health crisis and have those conversations with them. After 9/11, the mission changed. Oh, let's go back. We had community policing. It afforded us an opportunity to get out of patrol cars. It was funded by the federal government, where agencies could actually write grants. And then as a result of those grants, you had people that were assigned to do nothing but community police.
So given your expertise, given your experience, you know, what should the job, in your opinion, be?
It has to be a little bit of all, because there's one other thing that I got to kind of throw into this pot. 9/11 changed everything. The police mission changed from being, you know, like agencies wanted to be in partnership with their communities to actually having a responsibility to responding to terrorism. And so that meant that all the money that went in community policing that came from the federal government, it went into those efforts. The way I look at policing today, it should be a mixture of all of those things.
So I want to ask you this. So, you know, a lot of protest time is given to this notion of the chant defund the police. Some rephrase it as reimagining of police forces, looking at municipalities, redistributing the funds. So, you know, with this topic in mind, where do you respond to those kinds of discussions?
When they talked about defunding, when the first one I heard of defunding, and I have several friends that are chiefs. And you can only imagine, my phone just blew up. What are they talking about? They're crazy, you know. And I'm sitting here thinking, because we physically could not reimagine that what would happen if you said, okay, defunding to us means that you want to do away with us.
You may not have the solution, but what is your best guess for moving forward?
I think you can't leave local problems to be local problems. So the greatest way to handle this issue would probably be state oversight, to create something just like the Justice Department did when they had consent decrees, to be able to have independent people come in, do the investigation, look at the data sets and say, okay, this is what has to happen. And the state actually takes those agencies to court and hold them, and they can do the same thing and hold them accountable through some sort of decree that is done at the state level. Then you don't need the whole outside thing from the federal government. The other side of that is, if agencies are smart at this point, what they should be doing is reaching out to the community and having those conversations. And I don't mean the chiefs of police, because the chief sees it one way, and they have this the way they want their department to run. But the line guys, like I used to be, they need to be sitting in those meetings and having those conversations with people to understand what the people feel and what they see.
That was VOA's Steve Miller speaking with Dr. David Thomas, forensics professor at Florida Gulf Coast University. Rappler CEO Maria Ressa was convicted of cyber libel by a Manila regional trial court Monday, a first for a Philippine journalist. The case is also seen as retaliation over articles printed criticizing the Philippine president. Ressa faces up to 6 years in prison. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam announced the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee will be removed. It has been there for 130 years. But one Richmond judge has temporarily barred the state from taking down the statue on Monument Avenue. Licia Bakalets has a story narrated by Anna Rice.
This is how June started in Richmond, Virginia. Thousands of protesters gathered on Monument Avenue in downtown to express their opposition to a group of controversial statues of Confederate leaders that have stood in the city center for over a century. The police used tear gas to disperse the protesters, but later apologized for these actions. Just days later, Virginia's Governor Ralph Northam announced plans to remove the statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee, commander of the Confederate States Army during the American Civil War.
So I am directing the Department of General Services to remove the statue of Robert E. Lee as soon as possible. It will go into storage, and we will work with the community to determine its future. I know some will protest. Some will say Lee was an honorable man. I know many people will be angry. But my friends, I believe in a Virginia that studies its past in an honest way.
It was a Richmond councilman, Michael Jones, who started advocating for the removal of Confederate statues from the Monument Avenue in 2017. He insisted that having statues glorifying the people who supported slave owners during the Civil War are offensive to the Black American population.
My father grew up in this city. My mother grew up in this city. And so do my grandparents. I'm glad that they're coming down.
However, not everyone agrees with the governor's decision. Confederate heritage groups believe the statue should remain where it's been for over a century. And Virginia State Senator Amanda Chase created an online petition saying the General Lee statue should be saved, as well as other Confederate statues in Richmond. Chase says there's no denying these people supported slavery, but she insists they can't be defined by that alone.
You know, I've spoken advocately against erasing Virginia's history. This does not belong to Mayor Stoney. It belongs to all Virginians. It is our history. You know, let's be honest here. There is an overt effort here to erase all white history. I mean, that's what they're looking at doing.
The American Historical Association, in part, agree with the senator. Yet they add, while it's important to know various historical figures, not all of them need to be respected.
You can preserve your history in many different ways, but that doesn't mean you have to honor somebody. The problem is that where that statue exists now and the function of that statue, it's not just that it's saying this is part of history. It's saying we honor this man. And the point of moving it to some other place is to say no. We do not honor a man whose main accomplishment in life was to commit treason on behalf of the right of some people to own other people.
Historians add some controversial monuments might be at home in a museum. This will both remove them from the center of the city and save from vandalism, something Richmond statues have experienced firsthand many times.
Off public space and you put them in a museum, I think it saves the city a lot of money. It costs a lot of money not only to maintain those monuments, but then to clean them up once they've been vandalized. So it, in some ways, I think, gives us an opportunity to keep them around, tell a story, and save money all at once.
But the Monument Avenue Preservation Group has a different opinion on the matter. They believe monuments are an inherent part of the city's history, and they cannot be removed. The General Lee Monument belongs to the state, so the governor is authorized to make the decision about its removal. On June 9th, a Richmond judge temporarily blocked Governor Northam from removing the statue. But the state appears to be preparing to move forward with the removal plans after the 10-day injunction is up. The future of the other statues will be decided by the city council. For Леся Бакалец in Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. Japan's defense minister says they're canceling plans to deploy a costly land-based U.S. Aegis Ashore missile defense system. It's designed to counter escalating threats from North Korea. There were concerns over safety in two nearby communities. You'll have all the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, a U.S. astronaut made a historic visit to the depths of the ocean floor while the space agency unveiled this year's Hall of Fame roster. NASA continues marking milestones more than a week after the first man launched from U.S. soil in nearly a decade. VOA's Arash Arbasadi brings us This Week in Space.
Spacefarers don't always make history in the heavens. Sometimes they do it by exploring the ocean deep instead. Sunday, astronaut and oceanographer Kathy Sullivan took a breathtaking trip off the coast of Guam, going down about 11 kilometers in Pacific waters to reach the deepest point on Earth. Sullivan became the first woman to visit Challenger Deep at the bottom of the Mariana Trench. She's also the first person to have ventured to the planet's floor as well as space. She tweeted this photo with the hashtag World Oceans Day, observed June 8th. Sullivan appears in this 2013 photo with fellow astronaut Pam Melroy, who was selected this week for induction in the Astronaut Hall of Fame.
You know, I have enormous respect and admiration for the people and the former colleagues that sit on the selection committee. And it can't help but make you feel good when people you respect and admire honor you in this way. I mean, that's pretty amazing.
Melroy will join Sullivan and other NASA alumni at the Hall of Fame in the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex in Florida. As NASA preps for moon missions, the agency is taking note of natural engineering marvels on Earth. Researchers in California are studying underwater real estate they jokingly call snot palaces. Tadpole-like creatures build complex structures made of their mucus atop their own heads. The mucus protects them and filters their food. Bioengineer Kakani Katija explains the deep sea research.
We're hoping that this opens up, you know, other studies in terms of, you know, how are these structures built? How can we reconstruct them on our own? Like, could we make something similar to this? You know, these are expanding structures that may start like a millimeter in size, but reach a meter across. You know, how can we do that ourselves and build expanding structures?
The creatures are humans' closest relatives without a backbone, and they build structures equivalent to a five-story home. The research could one day help NASA engineers tasked with building structures for humans on the moon. Finally, and for only the second time ever, astronomers detected fast radio bursts, or FRBs, coming from space. The Lovell telescope in England caught the pulsing pattern, which repeats every 157 days. Scientists don't yet know the cause of the unusual and tantalizing phenomenon. Arash Arbasadi, VOA News, Washington.
A message from your friends at VOA Asia. Wash your hands with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. Scrub thoroughly for 20 seconds. If you cannot wash your hands, use a hand sanitizer. Taking these steps can prevent not only coronavirus, but also colds and flu and other viruses. A message from your friends at VOA Asia.
Now on VOA Asia, a surprising student behavioral shift that, according to one professor of social studies of science and technology at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. She says her students now prefer communicating by text rather than face-to-face. VOA's Adam Phillips talks us through those changes.
And I started to interview them about it, and it was clear that it made them feel less vulnerable.
How so?
You never know what the other person is going to say, and you have to make it up in real time.
If you put it that way, in-person communication does seem a bit more stressful.
That's true, but talking face-to-face also means you can make eye contact, you can take in the full body and gestures and voice. You pick up so many cues about what's really going on.
So how does Zoom compare with what you learned about texts? You're face-to-face in a sense, but it's still on a computer.
Well, I've been doing some interesting studies that show that for some purposes, you really are better off with a telephone call. The focused attention that you can give a voice is better than Zoom. That's why radio hasn't disappeared. Now, for teaching, for meetings, when partners and families can't be together, I think Zoom is very good for that. And, you know, clearly people are doing very creative things with Zoom. I'm teaching on Zoom and I'm working very hard to make those classes exciting. But I'm looking at 30 little postage stamp faces. And if you're just seeing me on a screen with a fake background, it's not natural.
So face-to-face is more natural, in your opinion, because there's more human emotional information in it.
Part of what we say when we say face-to-face is we really mean body-to-body. How does a mother know their child is anxious? Through so many dimensions of how their muscles and neck are sitting, how their forehead is sitting. And in Zoom, you never are looking at the person's eyes. You know, I don't want to sound churlish or, you know, negative, because I'm grateful to this technology. Were it not for this technology, I would not be able to teach my classes. I think my classes this semester have been extraordinary for me, have given me a deep insight into the experience of my students, which has been very difficult. And I think we're all very sustained together in these classes. But here's what I worry about. I worry that there are going to be a lot of businesses and a lot of small universities and a lot of enterprises that are going to say, you know what? It's really cheaper to do all this on Zoom. But after all, it probably did 60% of what we need, and 60% is good enough for us. And I worry that we're going to be losing the wrong 40% of what we need as educators, of what we need as healers, as what we need as people.
So you would advise against using Zoom in most cases?
Well, it depends what our purpose is. All technology depends on what you want to use it for. So if the purpose is setting me up to do an interview, let's say it accomplishes its purpose. But if the purpose was writing a significant article about me that really captures my essence in some way, I would say you should spend an afternoon with me and have a meal with me. We want to be most human to each other. So it's a complicated thing that's going on now. And I think that really what's important to keep in mind is, what are your human purposes? This is my big message in all my works. If you're a therapist and your patients have gotten so used to doing things online that they're telling you that they don't want to come in, well, that could be more convenient for me. I can start seeing patients all over the world, basically. But is this really serving the human purpose of my really being the most intimate therapist or doctor that I could be, or all this telemedicine? Am I being the best doctor I could be if I can't lay on hands? So I think the big question is not what it's like to be in quarantine in these very extraordinary times. I'm saying that let's be very careful as we move ahead what we do with this experience.
That was VOA's Adam Phillips interviewing Professor Sherry Turkle at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. You have been listening to VOA Asia. Like us on Facebook, VOA Asia. Follow us on Twitter at VOA Asia. You can find us on Instagram, YouTube, and at voanews.com. We thank our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, Ira Melman, and Jim Stevenson. I'm Amy Polpe-Boone in Washington, D.C.